My hand was now shaking, the old pepper box's battered parts rattling so loudly that I had to cradle the gun in my arms to hide the sound of my nerves unraveling. Coonan's pistol lay on the barn floor. By the time the man belted his pants, I had gripped the pistol with both hands and turned to the next loaded barrel. Coonan reached for his gun, and I fired again.
Welcome to Dead Man's Hand Podcast, where we examine the life of Wild Bill Hickok and delve into the stories that made him a legend.
In this episode of Dead Man's Hand, I share chapter 2 of the novel, which delves into Hickok's childhood, most of which we only have a circumstantial understanding of. We do know about his family that it does go back to Stratford-upon-Avon in England, Shakespeare's own home, and then to colonial America and the Revolutionary War, and eventually his family moved out east. His father was a good, serious, and religious man who helped in the struggle against slavery by allowing his farm to be used as an important stop in the Underground Railroad in Illinois. While this book falls under the genre of historical fiction, all of it either happened or could have happened, while never veering from the historical and personal context of Hickok's life. Now, this chapter does take some artistic liberties about exact events, though the characters and circumstances of what Hickok's childhood are very close to the truth. Let me just say that we appreciate your support by just listening to our progress on our multimedia project that we are calling Dead Man's Hand. When everything is all said and done, this project will have resulted in several products. One is a docudrama, as I've discussed about before, about Hickok's life. Two novels about Wild Bill, including the one that you're hearing now. An original album of music. And this continuing podcast. Now, this may be the last free chapter I put online. That could change. I might post one more. However, if you subscribe and provide your email address, I will send you each audio chapter as it is completed so that you have the opportunity to give us a review when the book actually comes out. Now, our target is May. That could change, but that's our target at this point. So if you want to continue hearing this novel in audio format as it progresses, be sure to subscribe, and we appreciate your support. Dead Man's Hand, Chapter 2, by Jerry Allen Heidela and Daniel Heidela.
I grew up on a farm in Illinois with three older brothers, two sisters, and an adopted sister named Hannah, though our farm was anything but typical. We served as a stop for the Underground Railroad, helping to hide and sometimes transport escaped slaves fleeing from their captors and bounty hunters on their way to Canada. You might think that would be thrilling for a 12-year-old, but it only meant more work and the added responsibility of keeping watch on top of my usual farm chores that began at dawn. I longed for an escape, whether it was in the nearby woods for hunting, exploring with my older brothers, or accompanying my father to Homer, the nearest town. One day, I persisted in asking to join him on his trip, even though my father was reluctant to leave Mom exposed to the threat of bounty hunters.
Can I go with you?
I pleaded as I watched him prepare his horse.
I have money down on that gun!
The image of the rifle in the storefront window lingered in my mind, its brass plating gleaming. I could almost feel the weight of the Harper's Ferry in my hands, imagining the accuracy and speed it would offer compared to the old flintlock passed down to me. I can't help but wonder how differently my life would have unfolded if my father had granted my wish that day.
You stay here and help out like your brothers,
my father instructed, his tone heavy with responsibility.
I need you to keep an eye on your sisters and mother, and Hannah. Do you understand?
I understood all too well. The risks we faced were constant, especially after we had adopted Hannah, who arrived one day with a group heading to Canada. Her parents were dead, and abolitionists had rescued her from a similar fate. I remember seeing her for the first time. She was slightly older than me, but taller, nothing but skin and bones covered by rags. Her frightened eyes regarded us as if we were monsters. My parents refused to send her on to Canada before they had a chance to help her regain her strength, even though she remained withdrawn, retreating deep inside herself to escape the dread and ugliness of her past. A year later, she became part of the family, someone who scolded me like my other sisters for my manners, doing so with a smile that made me want to hug her, though I dared not.
Yes, I understand, but it's just not fair.
I protested, frustration boiling over.
You took Horace last time.
You'll do what I say, boy.
My father's voice rang out from atop his horse.
Get your rifle and keep watch. While you do that, make sure to weed the berry garden for your mother. I expect it done by the time I return.
As I surveyed the fields where my brothers toiled, I found consolation in a less demanding chore. After my father left, I walked to the neglected berry garden outside the kitchen window. The overgrown weeds felt like the futile struggle of farm life, a battle against nature that never ceased, never paused, never allowed for a moment of peace. The scent of baking wafted from the nearby window. I knew better than to intrude on my mother's and sister's space, so I picked up a hoe and began clearing the garden, all the while yearning for the freedom of the woods and the thrill of the hunt. My gaze drifted toward the forest, hoping to catch a glimpse of wildlife or find any reason to abandon my responsibilities. Instead, I saw my brothers disappearing into the woods, rifles in hand. They must have planned this all along, ready with their guns the moment Dad left for town. I considered calling out to them, trying to convince them to wait for me, but that would only alert my mother. My father's voice echoed in my mind, reminding me of my duty to protect my family.
I know.
I muttered to myself, trying to silence that internal voice. Frustrated and restless, I sat down among the weeds and began to eat strawberries while plotting my next move. If my older brothers refused to take me to town, I decided I would use my knowledge of their hunting trip as leverage. If they didn't want to include me on the next outing, they could face Dad's fury. Suddenly, the distant sound of thundering hooves startled me. I knelt, my head barely above the weeds, and saw someone approaching our farm at a frantic pace. It was Jacob Coonan, a local farmer known for his drunkenness and cruelty, especially toward his family. Mom had us pray for his family nearly every night. Why was he coming to our house? Coonan slid off his horse and stumbled, but managed to regain his balance as he barged into our home. Although he knew about our farm's secret operations, he had never interfered. My father never mentioned him when discussing external threats to the Underground Railroad. Sure, Coonan caused mayhem in town when he drank, but he was no slave hunter or bounty hunter, unless he had run out of money for booze. I slipped unnoticed into the house and hid behind my father's chair in the living room, listening as Coonan demanded to know about hidden slaves on our farm. My mother's defiance only seemed to fuel his drunken rage, threatening the fragile peace we had fought so hard to maintain. In that moment, a newfound resolve stirred within me, a determination to stand against injustice and protect my family from harm. Gripping the chair leg tightly, I realized I alone had the power to confront Coonan. He pulled out his pistol. My only chance against the large, drunken man was to get hold of a gun, but my flintlock rifle was in my room on the other side of the kitchen, an impossible distance to cross. My brothers had already taken their guns into the woods, and my father always brought his rifle and pistol into town, leaving only the pepperbox pistol beneath my parents' bedroom as my only hope.
She's a pretty little thing, isn't she?
Coonan said, lowering his pistol and trying to peek at Hannah, who was cowering behind Mother.
How old is she?
Step back, Mr. Coonan,
my mother said, thrusting her hand a few inches from his face.
Move back, and I will tell you anything you want to know.
Coonan took a step back, but then had to catch his balance as my mother turned, wrapping her arm around Hannah and pulling her upright.
She's 14.
Close enough to marrying age,
Coonan smirked.
Hannah, please take your sisters into your room and wait while I get Mr. Coonan something to eat.
Coonan didn't wait for her to comply. He seized a loaf of bread cooling on the windowsill and took a bite out of it. Hannah coaxed the girls out from under the table and dashed out of the kitchen before Coonan could react.
I'll cut you a deal,
he said, shoving the pistol into his belt as he took a seat at the now empty table and took another bite of bread.
I'll leave you the little slave girl if you hand over the others you have holed up on your farm.
You can search for yourself,
my mother yelled.
But you'll find nothing but a poor farmer's possessions and a little bit of stored food. It's just me and the kids on this farm right now.
You're lying!
He shouted, slamming his fist down on the bread.
Where's your crawl space? Show it to me. Where's your hiding place?
Coonan stood, flipped the table in a rage, and began stomping around the room. I nearly sprang from my hiding spot behind the wall and lunged at him, but I stopped myself, clinging to a sliver of hope. Instead, I ran to my parents' room on the left, praying Coonan didn't notice me. My father had made sure we all had weapons in our rooms in case dangerous men caught us by surprise at night, and to meet up in our parents' room where he had three guns and an escape door built into the floor. His third gun was his old pepper box. I assumed he kept the pistol in the space beneath the trap door, but it wasn't there. As I crawled beneath the bed to look, I could hear more dishes shattering in the kitchen and my mother's voice rising in panic. Why wouldn't he leave the gun in an accessible place? I cursed my father as I carefully turned over every item in the small room and opened every drawer. Realizing I would have to run to my own room to retrieve my rifle, even if it meant running straight into Coonan. In my frenzied search, I ended up tearing the blanket off my parents' bed. Only then did I notice the butt of a pistol sticking out from under my father's pillow. I had never thought to look there. A shiver ran through me as I considered how close my father had always been to danger. I lifted the pistol and balanced its weight in my hand. It felt so heavy. I had only shot the multi-barreled flintlock a few times, and it was terribly inaccurate beyond 10 yards. Yet any gun felt like an extension of my body, a natural reflex of my hand, fingers, eyes, and thoughts. For me, shooting a gun was like swinging a fist. I rarely missed unless I couldn't see my target, or if circumstances conspired against me, like a misfire or malfunction.
You're a dead shot, James,
my father would often say, acknowledging my talent during our hunting trips, though he never elaborated, as if he believed God had no righteous purpose for such a skill outside of providing for one's family. But in that moment, I understood why God had made me a good shot, and wondered if this was how David felt about Goliath, that a bigger target only made shooting easier. I heard footsteps thundering through the house and returned to the kitchen, where I found my mother clutching my two younger sisters.
Where's Hannah?
I asked her.
He's gone after her, James. He's going to take her.
I won't let him,
I said, the gun hanging from my hand.
Be careful, James. I don't want to lose you too.
I dashed outside and caught sight of Hannah fleeing toward the barn, with Coonan limping after her. I raised the gun, pulled back the hammer, and squeezed the trigger. The flint sparked, and a shot echoed across the farm, halting Coonan in his tracks.
What are you doing, boy?
He shouted, pulling out his pistol and firing in my direction. I froze as the bullet struck the ground just a few feet in front of me, sending dust into the air. I didn't want to die, but I wasn't scared. I didn't trust Coonan's skill or state of mind. The only thought that troubled me was the thought of killing a man. My dad frowned upon violence in any form. Yet he had told me and my three older brothers that there were times when taking up arms against our fellow man was necessary.
Your job on this earth is to love God and love man,
he would say.
But there comes a time when God smites the wicked, and sometimes we are called to be the arm of his justice.
I knew I was within God's jurisdiction and would have shot Coonan dead at that moment, but he was still a man. Perhaps he would change his mind, wake up from his drunken haze, and realize the evil he was committing. Hannah had disappeared into the barn, and Coonan paused to catch his breath. Maybe he would just give up. I lowered the gun and waited.
James!
Cried my mother from the house, holding my flintlock rifle. What was she doing? I knew she couldn't shoot, and she certainly had no business with the flintlock, which only fired 1 out of 3 times.
Go and save Hannah!
I turned back and saw Coonan run into the barn. My mother's words gave me the courage I needed. Until that moment, my thoughts had been filled with hunting, swimming, and eating fresh pie. Now, Hannah's life depended on me, and I ran to save her. The barn was dark, and I was momentarily blind until I spotted Hannah, trapped between Kunin and the wall where the tools hung. He grabbed her, threw her to the ground, and jumped on top of her.
Get off of her, or I will shoot you dead!
I screamed.
You best leave us alone, boy. You ought not to see this.
I lifted the pistol, rotated the barrel, and pulled back the hammer, aiming as if I were shooting the eye of a squirrel to minimize my error. I couldn't afford to actually kill the man. Though I would be in God's favor for saving Hannah, the LaSalle County Sheriff would have questions, likely investigating the commotion on our farm and taking Hannah into custody himself. Besides, I had no interest in cleaning up brain matter and blood, knowing the mess of slaughtering farm animals all too well. Kunin placed his hand on Hannah's leg and began kissing her neck. I dropped the hammer. Flint sparked. The pistol discharged, filling the barn with black powder smoke. I couldn't see at first, but Kunin's head was bare, his hat several feet away, no doubt torn by the bullet I had just fired. Kunin rolled off of Hannah and fell to his knees, gingerly checking his dirty scalp for injury.
You almost shot me, you little bastard!
He yelled, standing up and pulling up his pants.
Run!
I yelled to Hannah, who shot up and fled out of the barn. In that moment, something changed within me. I no longer saw Kunin as a man, but as a threat to everything I held dear.
I'm gonna beat you, boy!
Kunin growled.
When I'm done, your own parents won't recognize you.
My hand was now shaking, the old pepper box's battered parts rattling so loudly that I had to cradle the gun in my arms to hide the sound of my nerves unraveling. Kunin's pistol lay on the barn floor. By the time the man belted his pants, I had gripped the pistol with both hands and turned to the next loaded barrel. Kunin reached for his gun, and I fired again, this time hitting his weapon and sending it spinning several feet away. Saliva dripped from his beard like a rabid beast as he searched for another weapon to use against me. He settled on a pitchfork, lifting it like a spear. I aimed the barrel and fired again, striking the handle and sending the pitchfork clattering to the wooden floor.
Well, ain't those the luckiest shots I ever saw?
My nerves returned, and the pistol shook in my hands like a rattler's tail. Kunin stepped slowly toward me, extending his hand as if to catch any bullets that might come his way. A calmness washed over him as he wiped away the sweat and saliva, adjusting his demeanor to that of an authority figure.
Listen here, boy,
he said.
I'm going to let this matter go as long as you throw that pistol down and let me return that slave girl to her master. I won't even tell your old man that you tried to kill me. I can't imagine what he'd do.
Kunin was unnervingly calm, as if my trembling limbs had rendered me powerless and no longer a threat. He held no weapon, offering his flesh as a target. I could put a bullet through his heart and contain most of the bleeding inside him, but how could I do such a thing? Kunin was a man created in God's image, born of a mother who loved him. Somewhere, that mother would grieve and kiss his dead cheeks if I pulled the trigger.
Give it here, son.
He was just two steps away from grabbing the barrel when something shifted inside me. As I focused on Kunin's rot-filled pores and creases, I no longer saw a man. I saw an enemy of all former slaves striving for freedom, with only me standing in his way. Lord, let me be the arm of your righteous justice, I prayed. A response overwhelmed me, not in words, but in the strength of my grip, the straightening of my back, and the release of all fear. I turned the barrel once more, pulled back the hammer, removed my left hand, and lifted the pistol sight until it settled between Kunin's furrowed eyes. Kunin seemed to see a change in my posture, or perhaps felt the quake of my shifting spirit. He raised his hands in the air as I put pressure on the trigger, willing to accept any mess or investigation in exchange for ending this man's terror.
I could have killed you already, Mr. Kunin,
I said.
3 times I could have killed you dead. Now you get off our farm, or I'll send you straight to hell.
The words flowed from the heroes of the dime store novels I read, much to my father's dismay.
You Hickoks are all crazy. Crazy, stupid bastards. The bounty hunters will know. Every bounty hunter from here to Georgia will come hunting the Hickoks until you're all swinging from ropes.
Realizing the shift in power, Kunin stumbled back toward our house where his horse stood, my mother keeping him in the sights of my rifle as he approached. He shouted at her as he mounted his horse and rode away.
I hate him, Dad.
I told my father that night, after recalling every detail. If not for the influence of the local Quakers, my dad would have beaten me for saying such a thing, and then would have beaten my brothers for abandoning the farm like good Presbyterians. But he hadn't laid a hand on his sons for 3 years.
The rot of that man's soul is a disease, James.
He yelled, grabbing the blanket as if to wring the life out of it.
You murdered him in your heart. In God's eyes, there is no difference.
I wept, hoping my father would be proud that I saved Hannah from further abuse. Mother entered the room with Hannah just behind her.
He did good, William,
she said.
He was the only man on the farm, and he acted like it. Maybe next time you won't put us all at risk by leaving us alone.
Oliver, Lorenzo, and Horace were supposed to be here,
my father replied.
Jacob Coonan would never have considered such a brazen thing if they had been around.
Coonan was drunk. He didn't care who got in his way. But what if it's a bounty hunter next time?
My mother responded.
We just need to be thankful James stood up to him and nothing worse happened. This Underground Railroad has made life too difficult. I don't know how much more I can take.
My father stood at the accusation, setting his hand on the doorframe, bearing the weight of a violent and hateful world on his shoulders. A weight I would understand all too well one day.
I am doing what is right in God's eyes. And that is what I expect from James, no matter the cost.
My mother sprang from the bed in rage.
No matter the cost? Are you serious, William? Don't I get a say in what we sacrifice? We almost lost Hannah today. We need to leave this cursed land. We should go west, where there isn't a slave trade, or back east, where life is simple.
This struggle to do what is right is our life,
my father replied without thought, as if obligated to a contract.
This is our mission. This is our fate, be what it may.
Mother stormed out of the room as she often did when her concern for our family conflicted with my father's concern for our moral obligations. But I said nothing, knowing it was pointless to defend my actions, yet still convinced I did the right thing. To please God and my father, I would have to forgive Jacob Coonan, a spiritual act that required a grace and resilience my father possessed, but I didn't understand.
You shot well with that pepper box, James,
said Father before leaving my room. I was shocked. Was he actually complimenting my use of his firearm?
It's not a reliable shot. I need to be point blank to hit my target. That is why it is my bed weapon.
It shoots to the left,
I said, wiping my eyes.
But it only had 4 shots,
he said, his voice soft.
I discharged the other 2 the night the bear came rummaging through the feed you left out. I never reloaded it.
I felt the moisture in my mouth evaporate as I remembered shooting 4 shots before finally chasing off Jacob Coonan, who assumed I had 2 more loaded barrels.
He would have killed you, James,
Father continued.
If you find yourself in a situation like that again, be prepared. Check your weapon, even if it takes time you don't have, because sometime you never get back.
Okay, I understand.
Threats loomed over our farm for the next 2 years, as the flow of escaped slaves to Canada increased daily, and the fabric of the country continued to rip apart into opposing sides. No intruder ever breached our household again, even though Father took on more responsibility for transporting wagon loads of ex-slaves in the dead of night to the next stop toward Canada. He had no choice but to take Oliver, Lorenzo, Horace, and me along to defend the souls we transported, shooting in the dark at the sound of bounty hunters on our trail. They were easy to spook at night, knowing the only thing between them and hell was a bullet they would never see, much less hear. The pressure of these dangerous runs, combined with the demands of daily farm life, proved to be more than our frail father's disposition could handle. He should have never moved to a farm. He should have stayed away from risk-taking and controversy. He should have remained in seminary or continued running a shop out east. Each day, he moved slower and grew quieter, as if planning his own escape from the corrupt grip of this earth. One day, he decided to send us into a panic by revealing his plan to secure Hannah's future by marrying her off.
She's too young,
Mother argued.
She's hardly had a chance to be a child.
Father looked at the family Bible sitting on the table in front of him, still open from his early morning reading.
She's 16, nearly 17,
he said without emotion.
You think she's young because we've only had her for a short while. She needs her own protector, her own future.
he said with finality. My 14-year-old heart was crushed. I had been secretly hoping that Hannah would remain on the farm long enough for me to take her away, to steal her into the Rocky Mountains where neither man nor beast cared for the color or creed of its inhabitants. But in less than 2 weeks, Father continued to demonstrate his efficiency for trafficking ex-slaves by finding Hannah a suitor in Edwin Williams, a freed slave and local farmhand who dreamed of moving east to pursue a career in medicine. Before leaving town, Edwin took Hannah to our farm to say goodbye. I didn't want to see her and only came out after she called for me. As I sheepishly approached, she pulled me into her arms. By that point, she was truly a woman. Soft, intoxicating, and strong, and she squeezed me until my heart broke inside my chest.
You are my knight in shining armor,
she said, releasing me forever.
I'll never forget what you and your family did for me. Thank you for saving me that day, and thank you for not killing him. I know he was good as dead in your hands. I am glad I don't have the memory of death on this farm. I will always picture this as my home. When I imagine my parents alive, I choose to think of them living here, sitting on the porch, watching the corn grow.
I was dizzy as Father escorted her to the coach where her husband awaited. I thought about that moment the rest of the summer, only adding to my intolerance of the familiarity of my daily farm routines. I was sick of the same faces, the smell of farm animals, the rows of corn and wheat, and even sick of the woods I knew as well as the farm. I could no longer lose myself in the state of Illinois, and I would have come up with my own plan to leave if Oliver hadn't already come down with a case of gold fever and planned on moving to California.
They're pulling gold nuggets straight from the streams,
Oliver shared with Lorenzo, Horace, and me behind the barn.
You're lying,
I said, hoping it was all true.
That's the honest truth, James. I spoke with prospectors traveling all the way from New York, heading west to stake their claims. We're fools to let this opportunity pass us by.
Lorenzo and Horace agreed and started arguing about how much money they had between them and how much more they needed to raise to join him. Oliver, on the other hand, knew exactly what was required. He showed us $127 in cash, more money than we had ever seen in our lives.
I've been saving every cent for the past 2 years,
he said proudly. He emphasized that if we were serious about following him, we needed to get serious about saving.
Why didn't you tell us sooner?
Lorenzo asked, indignant and red-faced with envy.
Yeah, we could have started saving when you did,
added Horace, who was the worst with money. I would have laughed if I hadn't been so disappointed at the thought of Oliver leaving us behind.
You would have told Father,
Oliver argued.
There's no way all of you would have kept it a secret. This was my only chance.
You want to be rich, Oliver?
Father said, stepping behind the barn and shattering Oliver's dream.
Is that what you're hoping for? And I suppose you plan to lead your three brothers down this same road to hell?
Actually, I was hoping the whole family would soon follow me,
Oliver replied, unable to meet Father's angry gaze.
Instead of digging up corn, we could be digging up gold. One good season of mining, and you wouldn't have to work for the rest of your life. This life is too hard on you. We all see it.
You want me to abandon the good Lord's work?
Father said, his voice low and filled with anger.
You think I should stop helping men, women, and children escape bondage and slavery for a fool's dream?
Father grabbed a handful of dirt from the ground and let it slip through his calloused fingers.
When you are dead and buried, gold is no more valuable than the dirt that covers you, and you would sacrifice the treasures of heaven for fleeting pleasures? Is that your plan, Oliver?
Stop preaching at me,
shouted Oliver.
You don't care about anything except God and slaves? What about us? Aren't we supposed to have something besides dirt?
That was the last night Oliver spent on our parents' property, even though he promised Lorenzo, Horace, and me that he would return in a year for anyone who wanted to join him. Without Oliver, what hope was there for us? How would I ever leave the farm? How would being a good shot help me? I could outshoot, outrun, outfight, and outsmart any kid in the county, but I was doomed to farming and helping the Underground Railroad until the operation was discovered and we faced the wrath of bounty hunters. I longed to escape this flat land of farmers and evil men and prospect in the golden hills of California or explore the West like Kit Carson and Daniel Boone. 2 months later, Father lay in bed, dying. The illness had come on suddenly, and local Quakers, abolitionists, former slaves, and friends took turns visiting him, telling him what a difference he had made, and praying that he would find the everlasting peace he deserved. But I had no interest in watching my father die. To my teenage mind, I would have preferred that a bounty hunter had shot him dead rather than endure a public state of deterioration. On the final Sunday of William Hickok's life, a few friends from church came to check on him, hoping he had survived the Sabbath. They wanted to lift his spirits with news of the expanding Underground Railroad and the increasing number of farms and churches joining the cause. They also shared that Jacob Coonan had been kicked in the head by one of his mules, causing him to walk unsteadily. Surprisingly, this incident had made him kinder to his family, easing their burdens, even if he spent most of his days sitting in a rocking chair and sipping tea. He had even started attending church on Sundays. This news brought Father joy, filling him with gratitude for God's grace and forgiveness, despite his frailty and the struggle to speak. I, however, preferred the company of visitors as Father lay dying. It provided a distraction from the breathing corpse in the other room. I let others attend to his frequent requests for water, food, or reading the word aloud. Assuming someone was with Father that Sunday afternoon, I decided to go fishing by myself. I only returned to the house when I heard his weak voice calling out,
"James!"
How did Father know it was me? I glanced out the window and saw my sisters reading by the manicured berry garden, which was no thanks to me, and felt compelled to enter my parents' room.
"Yes?
Come here, son."
Father's eyes peeked out from the hollows of his skull, and his mouth was open, struggling to form words. He lifted the frail branch of his arm and pointed to the open Bible beside his bed. I picked up the heavy leather-bound book containing God's communion with man and pulled up a chair. It was already open to the book of Daniel, and I read the passage my father had underlined.
"It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom."
I glanced at Father, whose eyelids stretched tightly over his bulging eyes like the skins of grapes. He raised and pointed his finger at me to continue.
"And over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give accounts unto them, and the king should have no damage. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm."
I paused to listen for his breath.
"You are meant to be a prince."
He said, summoning the last of his strength.
"Not a peasant. The difference, James, is in here."
He placed a hand on his own chest. That night, Father died, 10 days before my 15th birthday. As Mother cried and called for us to say goodbye, I remained in bed. I hated Father for his weakness and for dying so young. I hated my brother Oliver for heading west to seek gold without me, leaving us to watch Father die. I hated Hannah's husband for taking her far away, ensuring I would never see her again. I hated the pro-slavery people moving into our state, complicating our lives. I hated the anti-slavery people for hastening Father's demise. By the time I finished listing those I despised, I heard Father's voice admonishing me, as if my thoughts had caught his spirit mid-flight to paradise.
"The difference is in here."
"I know,"
I replied aloud. I waited for a response, for a sound, for more specific guidance, for Mother to assure me that everything was all right and that Father just needed some rest. But all I heard were the muffled words of Lorenzo, comforting Mother from the other room. As I fell asleep, I dreamt that Father handed me the glistening Harper's Ferry rifle from the store.
"Look at the evil coming, James,"
he warned.
"It comes from all around. Can you hide from it? Can you outrun its reach? Who else will stop it but a righteous prince?"